responses to the protests have taken place in Cali, in Cauca, in Medellin, in the Caribbean coast, I'm going to be heading to the coffee-growing region, to Pereira, and then later to Quindío. And we're going to be talking to frontline activists there. And these are the people who are being targeted. It's not an accident that they're being accused of terrorism, of vandalism, of causing violence, because that's been the discourse of the right for decades here in Colombia. Any political, social opposition against the economic, political model of intransigence, of authoritarianism, of militarism, has been silenced in that fashion.
We have to leave it there, but we will continue to talk to you in Colombia. Mario Murillo, award-winning journalist and professor at Hofstra University. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan González. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. It's Tuesday. Stay tuned for Too Much Information with your hosts, Tracy Simmons and Abe Proctor. Stay tuned.
Hey, good morning, good morning, good morning. This is Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name's Abe Proctor. Joining me, as she does every week, my illustrious co-host, Tracy Simmons. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Abe. Good morning, listeners. Oh, my goodness. Hopefully everyone has gotten some sleep since, Sunday night? I was up cleaning urine from my floor because my poor little dog, she just doesn't like fireworks like she used to. Never did, just kidding. But yeah, she's getting older, and so it literally is scaring the pee out of her. So that's what I do on Sunday night. My goodness. Yes, I'm all over the place this morning. I don't know. So we missed the show last Tuesday because there was an issue at the station. And, of course, you and I had planned a fabulous conversation about climate change and our triple-digit heat wave in Portland, Oregon. Like, what? What is that? It was also my birthday, the 29th.
Happy birthday.
And so, you know, I've been doing birthday stuff and all of that. And then, of course...
It's Engineer Sonia's birthday, too.
Yes! Woohoo! Handsome love! But, you know, just in the space of just like, wow, okay, I'm getting older. I grew up in Washington where, you know, when you were kids, if it was 70 degrees, we were like, bust out the slip and slide, you know, like it was like 100 degrees. And, you know, new reports show that over 90 or so people in the Portland metro area died during that time of extreme heat. And then, you know, to turn around and have, you know, not so smart people setting off fireworks for a, holiday that celebrates a revolution that wasn't really a revolution, that really granted independence for some people, but not all people. By setting off fireworks in one of the worst droughts we've seen on record, it just, I don't know, everything is so crazy to me. And I'm getting older, so my patience is just wearing really thin on some of these conversations. And even looking back on my own life and you know, the ways that I celebrated 4th of July in the past. Yeah, most kids love setting things on fire. We have all the stuff, right? But I just changed, and now I'm like, oh my gosh, it's my birthday. I feel old. Feeling old and tired and frustrated. And the fact that we're still having these same conversations. We're talking about climate. We're talking about houselessness. We're talking about, you know, even the truth about history, that so many people don't know the truth of the Revolutionary War, let alone the Civil War, right? And so even the founding of our nation, for many of us, was told to us as a lie. And yet we're recreating this by continuing to, you know, harm the environment, harm each other ultimately, because, of course, the fact that I didn't get sleep because my neighbors were setting off fireworks makes me angry at all of them, too.
All right. Well, now that we've opened up about a half dozen different cans of worms, I think we're ready to get started. As I mentioned, this is Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7. 503-231-8187 is the number to call to take part in this conversation. That's 503-231-8187. You can also write to us at the Facebook page, facebook.com/TMI. As Tracy mentioned, we didn't have a show last week. We were going to talk about the ridiculous state of hot water that we endured here in the Pacific Northwest and how that's connected with the much, much larger phenomenon of climate change. We're also going to talk about Independence Day, because that's a holiday that, as near as I can tell, is in a constant state of contextual flux, depending on our general state of self-awareness and our, as you mentioned, Tracy, our familiarity with the actual facts of history as it relates to the American Revolution. I also want to mention the fact that this conversation harkens back to some previous conversations we had during former iterations of this program regarding the 4th of July and regarding fireworks. Now, I got to tell you, listeners, that I have come around on this issue. I am no longer a big-time fireworks guy. I really used to look forward to it, and I really used to enjoy setting off fireworks. But I have come to understand, largely with your assistance, that the toll exacted on others in the community, folks who have been in combat, people's dogs, as Tracy mentioned, it's just too high a price. It's not worth a few moments of my fun to traumatize people and to send them back to times in their lives that they would be better off not revisiting. So I'm not a fireworks guy anymore, I'm happy to admit. Anything that I set off at 4th of July these days doesn't make any noise. Maybe I'll wave some sparklers around with the kids, but that's about it. But the other factor at play here, of course, is a couple of weekends ago, we tied an all-time record high, not just for Portland, but for Fresno, California. Mm-hmm. Let that sink in for a second. It has got as hot here in Portland, Oregon, as it has ever gotten in Fresno, California. Now, lots of love to Fresno. No, I'm not kidding. No love to Fresno. It's an armpit. It's a gateway to beautiful Bakersfield. And there's no reason that Portland, Oregon should be getting as hot as Fresno, California. It's absurd. And this, as you mentioned, what the death toll is, what, in the close to 100 people now and climbing from that weekend? It's this is not a joke. Global climate patterns are being more and more disrupted the longer we go on burning fossil fuels to drive the industrial civilization in which we live. I know that our listeners know all about this. We don't need to recover this specific ground. But when faced with a period of time like we just went through, it's hard not to come out of that and go, my goodness, we have to, we have to do everything we possibly can in the shorter period of time as we possibly can to avert this and maybe even reverse it over the long term. But it got really damn hot, Tracy.
It did, and you know, I think what I'm kind of wrestling with is the same thing that I'm always wrestling with, is who then is impacted by this kind of rapid climate change? It's people who can't afford air conditioners. It's people who are unsheltered. It's people who are already living in not so optimal living conditions, right? Living in cars or living with multiple people in a very small space. that are really at the mercy of our climate, right? People who are very rich can just get up and move. People who are very rich can, you know, be out on the boat or at the river or wherever they're doing, and have some respite from this kind of climate change that we're seeing. And so it begins to not only have a conversation about what we're doing about our climate, which I feel like is very little. The people who make rules, the politicians, the legislators, they're doing very little, almost nothing. And still having a conversation about what is infrastructure and what they're going to fund and what they're not going to fund. And at all the while, we're just seeing that the people who are going to be climate refugees are the people who are already the people in most need. And that, to me, is very concerning. The Willamette Week published a report a couple days ago about those heat-related deaths and noticed that they are in specific area codes. So 97206 here in Portland, which is central east side. I live in 97206, interesting there, but has the highest number of those heat-related deaths, in addition to 972-33, which is very close to Gresham, and 97266, which is also bordering Gresham, Lentz area. And so what we're seeing is that already places that are concentrated with poverty are having a disproportionate impact from the climate already. And, you know, I just feel like we need to get smart about how we advocate for folks, especially those in most need, who are going to continue being impacted. I hear in a couple of weeks we're going to have another triple-digit spate of hot weather. And so how do we prepare? How do we do mutual aid? What do we do for our neighbors that are unsheltered? How do we get people to resources? How do we get people to those cooling centers when things like the MAX is shut down because our infrastructure is broken, right?
Right. Well, because our infrastructure could never anticipate something like this on a sustained time frame, the way we're talking. I'm sure nobody thought. While awareness of climate change was a thing when the MAX was being planned and constructed towards the end of the last century, I don't think anybody anticipated a sustained run of high temperatures such that the train was unable to operate. And that's
right.
Yeah, that's a clear-cut instance of the pace of climate change and the magnitude outstripping the ability of our infrastructure to absorb that extra strain. And that's just an electric-powered light rail train here in Portland, Oregon. When we're talking about infrastructure crumbling under sustained climactic pressures, we are talking about incidences, like you mentioned, in Texas over the winter or in places around the country where the electric grid can't stand up during hot weather. The frequency and the severity of extreme weather incidents are on the rise and are expected to continue to be on the rise. So we're going to see our infrastructure put under this sort of strain more and more often. And in the worst case scenario, Tracy, we're looking at the dislocation of potentially millions of people around the world as they leave areas that are no longer inhabitable by human beings. This is what we're looking at. And you're talking about those zip codes you mentioned here at Portland. If you're wondering, do vulnerable communities feel the brunt of phenomena like climate change disproportionately? Do they suffer at a greater extent than their more well-off neighbors? The answer is absolutely yes. So if you're looking for the intersection of social justice and climate change, you need look no farther than the people who passed away here in Portland because of the heat. And that's just one example of how these two things intersect. It doesn't give one a lot of it doesn't put one in a carefree frame of mind. Let's just put it that way. The future is going to be filled with more and more and more of this. And the better we understand it now, the more steps we take to mitigate it now, the better we will be off in the long term. But as you mentioned, again, what do we do about it now? How do we make those decisions now if the people in the position to make them are unwilling to take them because of the dynamics surrounding how they fund their positions of power, how they win elections, how they maintain their seats? All of the compromises that any member of the United States Congress, for example, must undergo, all of the hoops through which they must jump, all of the people to whom they are beholden by the time they take power. if that means we can't make decisions on these most fundamental of issues, then guess what else is broken? Guess what else is broken? It doesn't give one a whole lot of hope, Tracy.
It really doesn't. And, you know, I feel like, for me, my sense of urgency just continues to increase, you know, and I make the, you know, kind of connection to having a very small new person in my family, my little grandson, and thinking about, like, what is the future going to look like? And, of course, I've seen some of the, you know, movies like, you know, post-apocalyptic, you know, Earth, and like, is that really what it's going to be? Because no one seems to be able to do anything about it, and it's kind of wrestling, like, with why that is. I'm thinking about human psychology of denialism, right? That you see something happening, it's happening right in front of your face, yet the larger impacts and potential for that thing is off into the distance and something that you can literally plausibly deny. But right now, this is like in our face. Like, you can't really do that anymore. Back in the day when we were talking about, you know, chloral hydrocarbons, whatever the heck it was, like, oh, you don't spray those aerosol cans, right? We got on a kick about straws, you know, in the last 5 years, right? No straws. Straws kill the turtle. Like, we're trying to, like, solve for a huge issue with doing the dumbest things ever, right, that aren't really impacting that issue. We saw the highest temperature ever recorded in Antarctica, right? So, like, it's right here, but yet, because it's not, like, fully revealed itself, we can still sit in denial. And that human potential for denialism is really dangerous, especially right now, because it really is what's fueling the inaction. And, you know, I talk about inaction as oftentimes as dangerous or even more dangerous than action. Just to do nothing, to sit back and say, well, we're going to figure it out. And, you know, there's hand-wringing and wrangling and all these deals being made about infrastructure right now. And it's like, if infrastructure package does not come with a climate, you know, real focus on climate and the new Green Deal or whatever you want to call it, we're not doing anything positive to, you know, actually impact what we're doing to our Earth. And it's like, okay, well, if you're worried about making $1 billion next year, and that's why you don't want to, you know, support this candidate who's supporting green energy or whatever, realize you're not going to be making any money into the future because we're all going to be dead. I'm really getting to that point where it's like, oh, I'm just, yeah, frustrated and having an existential moment with myself because I'm now over 40 and not quite halfway to 90, but like feeling this sense of urgency is just, it's making me so anxious, and I don't know what to do with that energy but to spew it all to you all on the radio. So there you go.
Lucky us. But you mentioned things like, for example, the ban on plastic straws. And no, I'm glad you mentioned it because I think it's important to mention this sort of thing in the context of what we're talking about. Yeah, it seems like almost a laughably small measure to take. Banning plastic straws, I mean, big freaking deal. You know, the fact is they do pose a significant danger to certain kinds of wildlife, and removing them from the ecosystem is a good idea. It takes on this mantle of absurdity, though, when you hold it up against the scope of the entire problem. It seems like shoveling sand against the tide. Why should we bother with plastic straws when the rest of this problem is so big? Well, the answer is, you know, we have to deal with the plastic straws, and we have to deal with everything else. It's not an either or proposition. It's a both and kind of proposition. And along those similar lines, there are a lot of things people can do within the sphere of their everyday lives to minimize the amount of combustive energy that they are consuming. And by that I mean the proportion of their daily activities that involves something that is powered by the combustion of fossil fuels. Now, here in Oregon, we might believe ourselves to be largely free of that, but that's not as true as you might think. We still got a coal-fired power plant, Boardman, here in our state, We still rely on hydropower to an enormous extent. Now, hydropower may be a slightly more advantageous source of power from the perspective of adding more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, but it also comes with a price. Rivers were not meant to be dammed. Their flow was not meant to be interrupted on the way to the ocean. Putting a dam across a river creates all sorts of secondary environmental and ecological problems regarding the movement of species along that river, and on and on and on. It's at best a more preferable solution, but not an ideal one. So to the extent to which people can liberate themselves from consuming carbon-based fuel, from doing things that depend on those sorts of chemical reactions, combustion, you can do, there are a lot of things you can do. You can plan your trips more efficiently and take fewer of them. You can use human-powered transportation to get around. You can, when you do have to use an internal combustion engine, combine your trips with other people to the extent possible. And we all know that, right? We all know all of these things that we can do. And we have to keep doing that. But when you look around, like you said, Tracy, and we see the big questions, the big phase changes that need to take place, and we are essentially still debating on whether or not, well, it might be a good idea to start considering making some of these large-scale changes. The only place in the world where there is a sustained debate on the reality of human-caused climate change is within one half of one chamber of the United States Congress. It is really down to a handful of conservative senators who, for reasons entirely having to do with their pocketbooks and their campaign funds, have chosen to remain ambiguous on the subject of human-caused climate change. And that is literally the only place in the world where scientific consensus does not prevail on this issue. And that, to me, is the most maddening fact of all, is that it is in front of everyone's faces, as plain to see. I couldn't be more obvious, but there's nothing we can do because a handful of rich old white dudes remains selectively myopic on the problem. It's maddening.
Maddening. I mean, I don't know what the rest of us are planning to do, but I don't know. My own sense of, like, not really self-preservation, but us preservation, like, preserving what we currently have, preserving the ability to live in, a society where we don't have to wear gas masks outside. And of course, we just were able to take off these, coronavirus masks in the last couple weeks here. And yet, I'm really like, oh my goodness, just think of last September when there were all those fires in the state and we were in the middle of a, coronavirus emergency. And we couldn't go outside because it was so smoky and so gross. And, to your point, talking about things that we can do, one of those things that we can do is not play with fireworks anymore. Like, can we just stop it? To the state fire marshal, Oregon State Fire Marshal, for the 5 years from 2014 through 2019, there were 1,172 reported fireworks-related fires in Oregon, resulting in more than $4.9 million in property loss and contents damage, not to mention human loss, limbs lost, all of that.
Oh, wow.
At the national level, from the National Safety Council, fireworks start an average of 18,000 fires each year, including 1,300 structure fires, 300 vehicle fires, and nearly 17,000 other fires, and I'm guessing that includes things like forest fires, right? And so we're now, because of coronavirus, restrictions being lifted, we're now able to go back into the Columbia Gorge and, enjoy the Multnomah Falls and all of that. But even going up there, you see the remnants of these fires from last year, and it's dark. I was just at the coast, and along the Highway 18 and going into Highway 101, you can still see the burnt trees and scattered areas, and people are living there. I just want us to, like, really pause and, to your point, think about the things that we can do individually, because it seems like the people who have the most power to make the most change are literally sitting on their hands. And so it's like, yeah, we have to take it upon ourselves and I've, you know, been really good in this last year of, you know, mostly working from home. That I'm not driving my car on a regular basis. I'm walking to the corner store if I need something. I'm walking to the market if I need something. I'm, you know, hanging out at the house or close to home. And, you know, as we have conversations, even locally in Portland, there are conversations about widening the freeway. Like, why? Why are we doing this? Right? To make it easier for more people to get on the road and pollute the earth? Like stop. I don't know. Stop. But I'm over it.
All right, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Let's go to Larry. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Nice show, folks. And all I have to add is a reference that I think could be very helpful to a lot of folks. There's a fellow named Nate Hagans. He's from the Post Carbon Institute. He's been writing for years about this situation, and he's just come out with a very watchable, accessible, movie on YouTube. It's 2.5 hours, but it's not negative. It's just a reality check, and it's called Earth and Humanity, Myth and Reality. And it's kind of like The Matrix. If you decide to take the red pill, you go down that rabbit hole. It's totally amazing, and it really will help see clearly where we are and what the possibilities are as far as getting us out of this hole we're in. So, anyway, Nate Hagans, Earth and Humanity. You can watch it on YouTube for free. So that's all I got.
Hey. Thank you so much for that. I can't wait to watch.
Excellent.
I love it when our callers give me recommendations for just knowing more and having a better understanding.
I agree. I totally agree. I think it's part of the dialogue that makes doing this so much fun. Let's go to Arthur. Good morning. Are you there?
Clearly where we are and what the possibilities
are. Okay, let's come back to Arthur if we can. The other topic, Tracy, that we were flirting with at the beginning of the episode, I think we ought to continue to discuss, even as we're having this climate change conversation, is Independence Day. I was looking over in my head, sort of doing a mental review of national holidays, and I think there are few national holidays, if any, that are as fraught as Independence Day or as subject to interpretation across as wide a scale as Independence Day. I think most members of the dominant culture in the United States, which is to say white folks, grew up understanding Independence Day in a certain way and celebrating it in a certain way. But that doesn't necessarily apply to people outside of the dominant culture to the same extent. How did you grow up celebrating Independence Day, Tracy? What does it mean to you and your family?
I mean, so I grew up in a cul-de-sac, and boy, oh boy. And so, you know, my aunt, Lorna, bless her heart, just had her 70th birthday. But, you know, we had, friends on the res and family members on the res, and we would get all of the fireworks, let me just tell you, all of them. And we would just blow stuff up. I mean, literally. So I did not grow up celebrating that holiday outside of the dominant culture. You know, I was, we were the black family in the cul-de-sac, right? So for a little while we had black neighbors, but they left after about a year or two. Neither here nor there. So, you know, I grew up, you know, we had barbecues and things like that, but it was a community event, right? And I also grew up in a school system that was predominantly white. And, you know, the narrative was about, you know, no taxation without representation.
Right.
And the narrative was about, you know, having the right to self-govern and not have the crown involved in you know, the realities of the United States, a country that was so far away and had all of these different elements, right? I'll say elements in air quotes, because what we're talking about is, of course, indigenous people and enslaved Africans. But, you know, we wanted to govern ourselves. But what's interesting in the United States is that, especially for the younger grade, say, you know, K-12, but skewing towards, you know, 8th grade and below, they gun down everything as far as history is concerned. And so I just remember watching the movie 1776, and it was a musical, and it was complete BS, but it was catchy, right? So, you know, you learn the songs, so you watch the movie, and it's like, oh, that's what it was about. But we don't learn history in America in international context. And so they didn't tell us things about, like, the Somerset case in 1771 in England, where there was a case where a black person, an enslaved person in England, was literally extricated from his community and told he had to go somewhere else. And in that conversation about the Somerset case, the reality is that the case was settled and said that, you know, slavery was odious. It would not be expanded in Great Britain. And it really put Great Britain on a track to abolition, which actually happened in 1805. And so the whole situation with the revolution, of course, there were people in the North who were very much being made lucrative in their pursuits based on the slave trade, based on slavery in the South. There were the Southern, you know, gentlemen who were owning other people who very much were interested in keeping that alive. Mm-hmm. And so what we see is a changing of the conversation in America about abolition at that time that said, oh, no, if that's the course that they're going, we want to separate ourselves. But we never have that conversation, right? And so we focus on the taxation, we focus on tea parties and, you know, all these other things, but we don't talk about the slave, slavery as an institution as also part of that quote-unquote revolution. And then, of course, there's the issue of over 20,000 enslaved Africans fought for the crown. Mm-hmm. Why would they do that, right? Huh? Why would they do that? Because they were fighting for their own emancipation, thinking that it would come if, you know, the United States remained part of Great Britain or the British colonial system, because it was going to be outlawed in that, you know, in that space. And so it's just fascinating, you know, being a grown person and being able to really delve into history from that more international lens gives me just a better understanding of, like, what I was taught, why we've done these things, what are these rituals that are part of the dominant culture that many of us, I will just say many of us, have taken on as our own, and to kind of stand back and be on the outside looking in like, wow, okay. I mean, even when you think about the Declaration of Independence and how central equality and how central freedom and liberty were to those documents, and at the same time, there are over, you know, at that time, a million people enslaved in the United States. And thinking about, the contradictions there are so ripe. And for other black people that I know, right, we celebrate differently, right? We're talking about barbecues, and not hot dogs and hamburgers, but like real meat. We're talking about dominoes and cards and, you know, playing and hanging out together and music and dancing and a celebration of sorts. But it's not about that same thing, right? It's about the fact that there is this contradiction in the founding of our nation that we're always working toward greater liberation for everybody, right? Because our liberation is tied together. So that's my take on it.
You're, it's ironic, isn't it, that the way we have ritualized this holiday, which commemorates in, I think, a real as well as a symbolic sense, the sort of sort of birthing of our nation as independent from Great Britain. It's the first of many great acts of whitewashing, and I use that word deliberately. We are covering up our original sin from the very beginning in this celebration, and in what we the set of values that we wrap up in the celebration of independence. You're right. Not everybody was independent. No, and even within the new constitutional order, which arose after some time had passed, obviously from the 4th of July, 1776, even in that new constitutional order, we didn't have anything approaching true equality. The only people who were enfranchised by that constitution were landed white men. And slaves were nothing more than a means to an end for those people who owned them in the southern colonies.
And they were a convenient source of bodies when calculating the size of a state's representation in Congress, and, interestingly enough, the size of a state's portion of the Electoral College. Uh-huh. So slavery from the beginning was part of creating this stupid electoral system that we still are saddled with today, all in the name of protecting the political capital of the slaveholding class from the South. So the whitewashing began even before we had established the constitutional order under which we now live. So there's irony upon irony in this holiday. And, you know, and in my opinion, if you want to celebrate your Americanness and your independence from Great Britain and the fact that among the modern democracies, the United States was first, I mean, that's fine. I think those are fine things to celebrate. But if you do so while remaining willfully ignorant of everything else that is wrapped up in this celebration, and indeed everything else that is wrapped up with our notions of freedom and individualism you know, small government and all those things that we traditionally associate with Republican, small R Republican values, if you don't spend time considering that contradiction, then you're missing an opportunity, and we're destined to not undo the mistakes that we began covering up from the very beginning. So it's a day of contemplation, in my opinion, in addition to celebration, or at least it should be.
Yeah, I think it's worth just a consideration, right? Even yeah. if you're not quite ready, right? Because I think, feel like going back to my earlier statements, denialism is a very comfortable space to be in as a human, and that's why, as a psychological mechanism for existing through really hard times, our denialism keeps us safe. Mm-hmm. But at some point, we've got to rip off these band-aids and realize some hard truth. Vox had an amazing article that they put out some time ago about the mistakes, the three reasons the American Revolution was a mistake, is the name of the article. And they talk about the fact that abolition would have come faster without independence. Independence was really bad for Native Americans, because as soon as there was independence granted to the United States, we started slaughtering wholesale and practicing genocide to expand into the whole West, all the way out to the yeah. Pacific Ocean, right? I mean, that came not as a mechanism of being a colony or a set of colonies under another system, but the fact that now you have these people who have been codified as people who are all created equal, and they're all land-owning white men, and now they have all of this power, and they can consolidate that power in a way that they can establish a whole system set up on their power and preserving that power. And that's what we have today. The third argument was that America would have had a better system of government if we would have stuck with Britain and been a parliamentarian system, as opposed to the interesting system that we've built that, you know, counted black people, enslaved Africans, as three-fifths of a person, right? Like, ew, that should make you feel gross, period. But it doesn't, right? Some people don't even know that. And so it's like, okay, how do we use this day to learn about our history and to really, you know, kind of explore some of those myths that we're all kind of conditioned to believe?
Here's an interesting myth. It's not even July 4th. It should have been July 2nd. There was actually a dispute at the time. The day that the Declaration was actually voted upon and ratified by the Continental Congress was the 2nd of July, 1776. We celebrate the 4th of July because that happened to have been the day when a bunch of copies of the Declaration were printed up and disseminated. So there was a rift among some of the founders on this. John Adams believed that it was going to be the 2nd of July that everyone would celebrate, and that the 4th was just when the press release went out, right? So here he is writing to his wife, Abigail Adams. Abigail, by the way, since we're speaking of the founding generation, is worth your time getting to know about. She is one of the United States' earliest feminists, and in my opinion, one of the most fascinating members of the founding generation. And her correspondence with her husband John and with Thomas Jefferson is wonderful, and I encourage everybody to give that a look at some point. But in any event, here's John Adams writing to his wife, Abigail. The second day of July, 1776, will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward forevermore. He got everything right, except for the day. The 4th we celebrate. And this was funny because there really was a division amongst the founding generation on which of these days they should commemorate. But the Declaration came out on the 4th, and over the ensuing decades, that habit of celebration became more and more calcified. And then until on 50 years after the signing of the Declaration on the 4th of July, 1826, both Adams and Jefferson died on the same day, on the 4th of July, within hours of one another, 50 years to the day after the signing of the printing of the Declaration of Independence. And after that happened, it was essentially enshrined in American lore, and it was always going to be the 4th of July. Mm. Weird, huh?
Fascinating.
I think Arthur is back with us. What's on your mind, Arthur?
Hello, good morning, Tracy. Good morning, Abe.
Hi.
Hey, you're making excellent points as usual. I will say, just offhand, I will say the following: that most people nowadays look at the 4th of July just as an excuse to shoot off fireworks. They don't really care about the history. Also, when I was in a different state than Oregon, we would just shoot off guns into the ground in celebration. But that actually, technically, is much, much safer than fireworks. But that's an aside. I want to contribute to the conversation a little. I want to contribute to the conversation just a little bit by offering some observations here. First, every time a person drives their car, they're actually farting into the face of their grandchildren. Okay, that's the reality of it. The internal combustion engine, it's got to be replaced by electric vehicles, but that electricity has to be produced by wind and solar, not the conventional fossil fuel. I'm a practical person. By the way, I'm living in a tent, and when it gets 90 degrees outside, a tent gets about 120 degrees inside.
Okay. Man, you got to be careful. We're going to have some more really hot days coming up here.
Oh, yeah. We're talking about water and getting out of that tent and trying to stay in the shade. Let me say, while I'm on it, I'm going to say that homeless people, they trash out parts of the city, no doubt. But they use way less energy than a common working man that's housed in a regular house.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, they're not using electricity. You know, they're not. They don't have running water. They walk everywhere. They don't drive cars. So that slam on the homeless people making everything dirty. You know, I keep my tent very, very clean. I'm not one of the people that's methed out totally. Okay, but let me make one more central point, two more central points. The trouble with electricity production in general is that it's done far away and transported, and Abe made this point, it's made far away and transported across electric wire to far away, which, by the way, also loses energy. I have a degree in math. Mm-hmm. And in Africa, in certain villages, they're actually more advanced. They got solar panels on every hut. You know, in parts of Africa, they use a decentralization concept. But Abe and Tracy, I can barely hear you, so I'm going to have to speak my last point, and then I'm going to have to hang up here. Okay, Portland has about 600,000 people in it. If one out of six people in Portland planted one tree each, I believe the math adds up to 100,000 more trees in Portland. And that has got to be a good thing for the city. We're talking about 100,000 trees, and it's possible. But, you know, I'm an idealist. I'm an idealist. And I'm sorry. What was that? Okay, my phone's cutting out, so I'm going to just hang up and...
Hey, thank you for the call. And please be safe. Please be safe out there when it gets hot. Tracy, you got any thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I feel like, and I'm saying this on a regular basis, it's kind of a broken record, that let's not focus on houseless people as the problem, right? The solutions to the problem are not them. The solutions are requesting that our legislators, the people who can make change, the people who have really been, you know, elected to do so, we put pressure on them. So absolutely, you know, people who are living in a tent are not using the same level of electricity. I mean, all of that is true. I also think at the same time that those extreme heats and those extreme temperatures are, humans are not made to sustain that kind of heat and still be able to think clearly, right? We know that heat stroke begins to kick in. I mean, there's all kinds of damage to the body that can be done. And so how do we hold two things true at the same time, that we are really looking out for unsheltered folks, but also thinking about how can we emulate some of the things that they're doing as far as not using up so much energy and so many resources all the time? You know, I feel really guilty to say this, but I had a tree in my backyard, and it was calling all the rats to the neighborhood because it was a fruit tree. It was a cherry tree. And not only that, my dog would eat the cherries, and then she would get really sick. So I literally cut down a tree. I confess this on air to all of you that I'm very, very guilty about that. And I am currently looking for another kind of tree to put in its place. So I absolutely agree. I feel like I did a horrible thing, and maybe I should plant two trees in my yard to make up for the sins of the earth that I have committed. Laughing, but no, I really am looking for some trees to be able to plant in that space, because, you know, I just couldn't do the tree. We had rats. It was gross. It was a mess all year long. And on top of that, to cap it all off, the cherries were not edible. They were so sour and disgusting that I would never use them for anything, not even to make a pie. So, you know, there's my confession for the day.
All right, let's go to Robbie. Robbie, good morning. Are you there? All right, well, we'll come back to Robbie when we can. So 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We're talking both about the heat-related climate experiences we've had recently. Well, that was kind of a mealy-mouthed way to say it got really freaking hot. Got really freaking hot, and it's because of climate change. That's what we're saying. And we're also talking about Independence Day and what it means from our perch here in the early 21st century. I got to say, when I was growing up, we did celebrate Independence Day every year in sort of the traditional fashion. You know, we had a cookout. We set off some fireworks. I grew up, though, in rural Northern California, and it was a roll of the dice every year as to whether or not any fireworks at all would be permitted. And most of the time when I was growing up, we weren't allowed to do any. So I guess after I came to Oregon, that I really became enamored with setting off fireworks. So I'll blame it on the climate here in Oregon, which was more hospitable to fireworks than where I grew up. Yeah, but like I mentioned, that's not something I really do anymore, really enjoy doing anymore. But yeah, there were a lot of people in my neighborhood who were keeping the dogs and everybody else awake well into the wee hours the other night. So it goes on and on and on. We have Robbie back.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Robbie.
Are you there? Hey, what's on your mind?
Yeah. So, I wanted to bring up, Tracy, if you're looking for a tree, Friends of the Trees, I believe, they actually will help you. They might even give you a free tree. I don't know. You know, you don't hold me to that, but I think if you contact them, they'll also tell you a good tree for, like, the habitat, maybe, like, a native tree that some of the local birds might like. But that would be a good resource I wanted to tell you about.
Yeah, they're great organizations.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah. And then the one thing that I kind of wanted to bring up was like, it's like not like I want to take it a step further. It's like, you know, it's not, I can't blame houseless people for living the way they do, being the way that they've been treated. And I wanted to, you know, take it. I take it with like the whole plastic straws and paper napkins. The thing about that is they're still being produced. So it's like we can, you know, try to not use them all we want. But the thing is like they're still using these, you know, plastics and producing them. And so it is going to take a little bit of a local effort, like what Portland's tried to do with, you know, banning plastic bags and the plastic straws. You know, they have to, you know, they provide them only when asked now. It's going to take a bit more of that because they're still producing them. And I wanted to keep that in mind. And then I had one last point too, is, you know, and it's just so sad that the deaths had happened here because of the heat with the, what do they call them? The heat pockets, I think they are, right? Where there's no trees. It's just such a shame though, because I'm looking at it right now and they're, you know, they're raffling off $1 million vaccine lottery ticket. And that $1 million probably could have opened up, you know, 3 or 4 more cooling shelters or helped, you know what I mean? That money could have actually helped people. And instead they're doing this raffle. And I just think it's so silly. And I mean, it's just totally against everything that I think should, you know, it's like, if we're here trying to represent, you know, this is for the, you know, we're trying to, you know, then they're going to raffle off $1 million, you know, it just makes no sense to me. And I just wanted to bring that up because I just wanted to point this out to everybody too, the Delta variant, when we hear what they're talking about with the Delta variant, all it is highly more infectious, not at all more deadly. People should look it up. It's not at all any more deadly. But I just don't see the rationing behind wanting to give someone $1 million to try to encourage more people to get a vaccine when we could have saved somebody. You know, we could have saved 50 or 60 lives if they used that financial incentive more properly.
Well, I don't know how efficacious that particularly picture attack is, but I think in terms of the reason behind it, it was, well, you know, what's going to break through someone's vaccine hesitancy? Well, the chance at a payday might be enough to break through someone's vaccine hesitancy. And so in that regard, I don't really have a problem with that particular tactic. It would be interesting to know.
But wait, I mean, $1 million would have stopped the heat thing and the death. Like they could have, $1 million could have went towards opening more cooling centers.
Oh, I'm sorry. You cut out a little bit while you're talking. I thought you were talking about the vaccination. My bad. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was trying to say they are offering the $1 million raffle of a vaccine when that $1 million could have saved those 50 to 65 people had we placed those resources right. You know, they opened up a limited amount of cooling centers. I'm glad they did, but in hindsight, it's like we're doing this for vaccine hesitancy on a variant that is no longer as deadly as the initial outcome. That's the role that viruses do. Viruses, as they evolve, they become less deadly because they want their host to survive. So we're hearing about how much more infectious this Delta variant is, but at the time we're dying now of, you know what I mean? And I'll go another step. I actually have a few families that I support in Gambia, in Africa. The shutdowns and the lockdowns have really, you know, just devastated the country there. They're extremely poor. And I think that's something that we're not taking into consideration with what's happened in the past year, is the cost of labor and all that. I'm switching gears on it, but I just don't think that the $1 million vaccine is going to help us, you know, make us safer. It just literally made us, you know, it did nothing. It's not done anything as far as I can tell. There's still not an increase in the vaccines. It's not creating this hysteria for $1 million raffle ticket. And just to, that's where I'm at, but I think that we could have done better with our funds.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, Robbie. And I thought that, you know, offering a lottery was pretty ridiculous. Given the fact that, like, if people understood numbers, they wouldn't be in for a lottery, right? Because the likelihood and odds of getting and winning the lottery was way less than the likelihood of getting and dying of COVID-19, unfortunately. So it's just, yeah, the irony. Absolutely.
Hey, listen, thanks for the call, Robbie. Appreciate it. I don't know. I guess I didn't have a problem with the whole vaccine lottery idea. That said, though, I would like to see if it was actually effective. Maybe it was just a waste of money in the end. I don't know.
Well, I can report to you that at this point, Oregon is reporting that we have reached a 70% vaccination rate of adults in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And that means that at least 70% of adults in Oregon have now received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. And that was published on Friday. So that's a good thing, right? We said that we were opening up on the 30th either way. So shortly after the 30th, we have this number come out. So we're at 70% of adults, but then when we look at those younger children who are still not able to get a vaccine, right, we've got to work mm-hmm. on that as well, because the Delta variant will still spread. And to Robbie's point, it is not known to be more deadly, but I don't want to get sick. That's just period. I'm good. I'm getting sick. And now that the state has opened up, you know, I think maybe in a future show we can talk about, are people still wearing masks? Do they feel weird wearing masks? I went to Tillamook. I went to the cheese factory out there. And literally me and the people I was with felt like the only people with masks on. Because it says, if you are vaccinated, you don't have to wear masks. Once again, right? How do I know that you're really vaccinated? I don't know. So I'm going to wear my mask just to be safe, just in case. Especially in, you know, enclosed, inside, you know, high-density spaces where there's a lot of human contact. Like, I'm still wearing my mask to the grocery store. If I'm outside, well, you know, I can figure out if it makes sense. But just wondering, like, how people are feeling about the fact that Oregon is now wide open, supposedly, but yet people are still practicing their own personal protective measures, and I'm just wondering how people are coming down on that.
That's a good question, and your comments bring up another question that's been on my mind, and that is, you know, people are acting like the pandemic's over, but the pandemic ain't over. like you mentioned, we're only approaching or just have hit 70% of vaccinated adults in the state, which is doing pretty well compared to a lot of states, Mississippi, in the country. But, you know, it's not over. You can still spread this disease. Asymptomatic spread is still a thing. And that's why I think the vaccination push needs to continue until we can get that number just as high as we possibly can and start bringing children in to be vaccinated as well. Because and if you have children out there, one thing I think we can all agree on without controversy is that children are really, really good at spreading pathogens to you and to others in their surroundings. So that's another vector that we can deny this virus if we're able to vaccinate enough children as well. So that ultimately, if everything works according to the grand design with vaccination, enough people will be immune to the virus that we can start approaching something like herd immunity, where enough of us are protected that we're going to be able to protect the more vulnerable people, immunocompromised people in our community, that going out in the world will be much less risky for them. And ultimately, we'll provide the virus with a series of cul-de-sacs down which it can go, but from which it cannot emerge. That's mm-hmm. probably, a bit of a clumsy metaphor, but I think it gets the job done. But we're not going to get there if we all decide everything is fine and we all start living our lives as if there's no more pandemic, because we are very much still in the face of this thing. Very much so.
According to the Oregon Health Department or Health Authority, more than 9 in 10 recent coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, and deaths in the state have been among residents who are unvaccinated or not fully vaccinated against COVID-19. So my final message for the day is, if you have got one shot and you have a two-course, please get that second shot. If you are unvaccinated, please know that you are risking your life and your health and the health of your community by remaining unvaccinated. It's very easy to get a vaccine at this point. if you were in the age range where it's available to you. And then if you have children who are in that age range of 12 to 15, they are eligible. So, you know, school's going to be back in session soon. Once again, I say this all the time, children are vectors of disease. They are little biohazards in a cute little package. Please, if you can, get your children vaccinated, do so, so we can all be over this. I mean, I'm, you know, mentally over it, but I'm still protecting myself because I feel the need to do that for myself and my community and my family. So,
yes,
take care of yourselves and others. Turn it over to you to close this out, Abe.
Yes, vaccinate your precious little biohazards, please. Please vaccinate your precious little biohazards. Yeah, I really want to reiterate what I just said. We're not out of the woods yet. There's still a viral pandemic that is ravaging much of the globe. We happen to be sitting in a position of relative privilege, not only with respect to most of the United States, but with respect to most of the world. So enjoy that for what it is. Please don't drop your vigilance. And if there's people in your family who are still hesitating, who still don't want to get vaccinated, keep trying to convince them. Do it for your, not only your benefit and theirs, but for everybody who knows them and lives in contact with them. So I guess that's it. This has been another episode of Too Much Information with A. Proctor and Tracy Simmons. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is A. Proctor. Thank you for tuning in. Tracy, take us out.
That's all. I guess it's almost 9 o'clock, so I got to run off and take my nap. Have a fabulous rest of your Tuesday, and we'll holler back at you next Tuesday. Take care, everyone.
All right.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
What was the Civil War and the Confederate flag really about? One of the things you can read about is a phrase called the Lost.